You are tuned to KGVM Bozeman.
Welcome to this Forthright Radio for June 27th, 2012. I'm Joy LeClaire. I'm very glad to have this opportunity to bring Kristen Iverson, author most recently of Full Body Burden, Growing Up in the Nuclear Shadow of Rocky Flats, to our airwaves. Kristen Iverson grew up in Arvada, Colorado, near the Rocky Flats Nuclear Weaponry Facility, and she received a Ph.D. in English from the University of Denver. She's director of the MFA program in creative writing at the University of Memphis, and she's also editor-in-chief of The Pinch, an award-winning literary journal. During the summers, she serves on the faculty of the MFA Low Residency Program at the University of New Orleans, held in San Miguel de Allende, Mexico, and Edinburgh, Scotland. She's also the author of the award-winning book, Molly Brown, Unraveling the Myth, as well as Shadowboxing, Art and Craft in Creative Nonfiction. Kristen Iverson, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, we're very glad, and I especially appreciate, on less than 24 hours' notice, that you have arranged to be with us today. Would you describe to our listeners the area around Rocky Flats where you grew up, and just what was being produced at Rocky Flats, and how come it came to be built there?
Well, I grew up in Arvada, Colorado, which is just outside of Denver and Boulder. It's a very beautiful part of the country. I'm sure many of your listeners are familiar with the beauty of Boulder and that whole area. I grew up next to Rocky Flats, which was a nuclear weaponry facility, a secret government plant that over the course of almost 40 years produced more than 70,000 plutonium pits or triggers for nuclear weapons. Now, just to put this in perspective, each particular pit contains enough breathable particles of plutonium to kill every person on the planet. It was a very dangerous operation. There was a lot of environmental contamination, toxic and radioactive materials. And we had no idea. Where I grew up in my neighborhood, we had horses, and we played in the fields. We rode our horses in the fields around the plant. We swam in the lake. We had no idea what Rocky Flats did or that there was any environmental contamination. It was all secret. And then later, like many of the kids in my neighborhood, when I grew up, I worked at the plant for a while myself.
And just how close did you live to the plant?
Well, Rocky Flats is very close to Denver and the cities of Arvada, Westminster, Broomfield. When I was a baby, we had a house in what's now called Old Arvada, which was about 7 miles from the plant. And then when I was 11 years old, my parents built a new house out in one of the new subdivisions out by Rocky Flats, and that was about 3 miles from the plant. So it's a very short drive from Denver, just a few miles down the road from Boulder. Rocky Flats was located in 1952. In 1951, when they first built the plant, they started production in 1952. They wanted a quote-unquote remote location, but they also needed to have a ready worker supply nearby, because Rocky Flats was not like Los Alamos, where they had all the workers right there on site. They had to have a large population nearby so that they would have workers for the plant. But the other thing that I would add very briefly is that there was a mistake in the engineering report when they first located the plant out on the plateau of Rocky Flats, and they based the engineering report on wind patterns from Stapleton Airport, which is actually over on the other side of Denver. And the wind patterns out at Rocky Flats are quite different, in the sense that the winds come down off the mountains at a very high rate of speed. They're called Chinooks. They're hot, dry, very fast-moving winds, and they move across the site and pick up contaminants and carry them right over the cities of Arvada and Denver and beyond. So there was a mistake made in the engineering report very early on. It's a bad location for a nuclear weapons plant. I think it's the only time in the history of our country that a nuclear weapons plant has been located so closely to a large metropolitan population.
Yes, and I can testify to those winds. I live just a few miles north in Boulder, and it's really something when those winds get going. Listeners may be aware that we have a fire one ridge to the west of Boulder. It started yesterday with lightning strikes, dry lightning strikes. The smoke has been pretty bad. So far, it's being contained, but this is one of a series of fires that is happening around the state. One west of Fort Collins is one of the largest in history. Just since I've moved here, we've had now three most disastrous fires in Colorado history. So this is part of the perspective of building a nuclear plant in this area. Now, you state in your book that there's a lot of euphemisms that get used in the history of the discussion of Rocky Flats. And one of them is the euphemism for what they were actually building at the plant. They're called pits or triggers. But you say they're actually A-bombs, similar to the ones at Trinity and Nagasaki. Explain that, please.
Well, the plutonium pit is called a trigger, but it's not really a trigger. It's part of a two-part explosion that happens almost simultaneously with respect to creating fission and then a fusion explosion. And the plutonium at Rocky Flats came from Hanford, Washington, and then it was shaped in foundries. They shaped it, and then it was shaved and shaped by human hands in what are called glove boxes. Workers would put their arms and hands into lead-lined gloves and work with these triggers within the boxes. And then they were sent to the Pantex facility in Texas, where they were encased in conventional explosives and become part of the actual bomb. So I think part of the euphemism here is that it was easy for people to say or to think about the plutonium pits in such a way that, well, these aren't the actual bomb. This is just a component, and then we send it off somewhere else, and it becomes an actual bomb. But it is, in fact, a highly dangerous and explosive piece in and of itself. It is the heart of every nuclear weapon produced in the United States.
So in addition to the potential danger on site and in the environment around it, we have all this nuclear material being transported all over the country. Now, in September of 1957, a potentially horrific disaster almost happened at the plant. Why don't you explain what did happen, to the best of your knowledge?
There were many fires at Rocky Flats. It's interesting. Of course, I'm very distressing that we're talking about fires in Colorado, you know, up to the present day. There were many fires at Rocky Flats, but two in particular, one in 1957 and one in 1969. Both of those fires were devastating. They were some of the costliest industrial accidents ever in the history of the United States. And the truth and the full story of what happened during those fires was hidden from the public, and I think much of the Rocky Flats story, including the information about these fires, continues to be hidden from the public. When my family moved out to our new house out by Stanley Lake, it was just before the 1969 fire, and one thing that happened as a result of that fire was that for the first time, the Department of Energy and Rocky Flats officials were forced to admit that there had been a fire and that there had been this fire in 1957, as you mentioned, which was a very devastating fire. It burned out all of the filters, all of the measuring equipment. They don't know exactly how much radioactive and toxic material escaped into the environment and floated over the city of Denver. That also happened in the 1969 fire. Now, when the 1969 fire happened, the DOE was, because there was independent testing by scientists and concerned citizens in the Denver area that proved that plutonium contamination from Rocky Flats was as far as 30 miles away from the plant. And the Department of Energy was forced at that point to not only admit that there was off-site contamination, but that much of that contamination did not come from the 1969 fire, which is what people were most concerned about at the time. but that it came from the 1957 fire, which was even more devastating, and also the fact that there had been thousands of 55-gallon drums standing out in the open that had the bottoms had rotted out and the material had leaked into the ground and the groundwater.
We're speaking with Kristen Iverson. Her latest book is Full Body Burden, Growing Up in the Nuclear Shadow of Rocky Flats. As you point out in your book, although it's very hush-hush, because of independent testing, there is evidence of a criticality accident that happened then. Also, one of the things that keeps coming up in your book is that although it was administered by the Atomic Energy Commission, it was managed by Dow Chemical for profit. And so there were cost-cutting efforts made, and one of that was that, for example, in these glove boxes you were talking about, they got redesigned, and in that process, the heat sensors were disabled in order to speed up production. Can you take it from there?
Well, I think it's safe to say, and certainly people even within the Department of Energy agree with this, that production trumps safety in every instance. And Rocky Flats was under so much pressure to produce a great number of plutonium pits at high speed as quickly as possible. And safety for the workers, safety for local residents and what was happening in the environment, that always was behind production, and production numbers were always the highest priority. Rocky Flats was not subject to any kind of environmental regulation until the late, when regulations came in effect in the 1970s, and then they fought it for a long time. So it wasn't until fairly late in the game that people were even really paying attention to what was happening in the environment. With respect to the heat sensors that you mentioned, it's true that often workers would do things to try to enhance productivity or increase productivity. And one of the things that sometimes happened was that they would turn off sensors or move them aside or whatever. The plutonium production buildings were crowded. And sometimes they would take a screwdriver or something like that and poke holes in the filters so that the material would be able to move more quickly along the line.
I should let the listeners know that this is by no means just a dry, fact-filled book. Full Body Burden, Growing Up in the Nuclear Shadow of Rocky Flats, has a great deal of, and I don't mean this in a derogatory sense, human interest as a focus. And among the individual people that you share their experiences with, listeners and the readers, are the firemen who had to deal with these fires. One of the problems, one of the many problems, you already mentioned that the buildings are very full of equipment and difficult to move through. They're like labyrinths. But the material is pyrophoric. Explain what that means and how that complicates dealing with fires.
Plutonium is highly flammable. And one of the problems with plutonium when a fire breaks out is that you cannot use water directly on the plutonium. You run the risk of creating criticality or a nuclear chain reaction. So it's very difficult to put out a plutonium fire. There are many heroes in my book in a number of different ways. I wanted to tell the story of Rocky Flats from the perspective of all the people, many people whose lives had been impacted and affected by Rocky Flats, and that includes workers, activists, residents, and certainly the firefighters. The two firefighters in the opening scene during the 1969 fire literally risked their lives to save the city of Denver during that fire, and it's an incredible story. The last firefighter in the book is a man by the name of Randy Sullivan. He fought the last fire in 2003, the last plutonium fire. Some of your listeners may be surprised to hear that we had fires at Rocky Flats as late as 2003, and he was contaminated in that fire. And this was someone that I had grown up with. In fact, he was kind of a fourth-grade crush, and we had stayed in touch. And it's a remarkable story, and I wanted to put a very human, I wanted to put a human face on an inhumane story, kind of an unbelievable story in some ways. And these are people whose lives were profoundly affected by Rocky Flats, including mine and my family. And I wanted to tell the story from that perspective.
My personal opinion is that you have succeeded really admirably. So often, these sorts of things are really just dry, fact-filled. And although there's plenty of facts, it's definitely fact-filled. You bring the human element into it.
And I wanted it to read like a novel. I wanted to tell a good story, but I wanted to tell a true story. And those readers who are interested as they read along, the book is very heavily footnoted, and they can flip to the back and see where this information came from and where they can go to get more information about a particular thing. But I wanted it to read like a novel.
Let's go to the title, Full Body Burden. What does that mean?
Body burden is a term that refers to radioactive material that is somehow absorbed into the body and continues to emit radiation over a period of time with the potential of causing a health effect. And, of course, the most serious health effect is cancer. Plutonium is dangerous if it's ingested through the body with respect to a wound or some kind of opening like that. But the most dangerous way to get plutonium into your body is to breathe it through the lungs, and very, very small particles of plutonium can settle into the lungs where they create an ongoing source of radiation, and lung cancer is often the result, although plutonium can settle in other parts of the body as well. The term full body burden, that's a government term, a Department of Energy term, that industry term, that refers to the point at which a worker has received the maximum amount of exposure that they can receive without any sort of anticipated predicted health effect. Now, the interesting thing with that term is that workers who've been exposed at much lower levels have experienced health effects, much, much lower levels, actually. And there are some workers who have had more exposure and they do not experience health effects, or they haven't experienced a health effect yet, although it does generally take 20 to 30 years for a cancer to show up after exposure to plutonium.
I was very happy that you cite numerous nuclear medical researchers, including Dr. John Goffman at the Biomedical Research Division at Livermore. And he was very famous for saying there is no safe amount of radiation that can be taken into the body or be the body to be exposed to. And he asked that the guidelines be reduced by 90%. But very typically, the Department of Energy or the Atomic Energy Commission at the time just ignored that. Why don't you share with us some of the efforts that were made by individuals? For example, Dr. Harry Nichols with his snow samples and what he found.
Well, there have been many instances over the years where different people, doctors, scientists, physicians, engineers, and physicists, have conducted independent studies that contradict what the Department of Energy and Rocky Flats officials say with respect to what is safe. And not only is there no safe level of exposure to plutonium, but there's also a lot of evidence that long-term low-level exposure to plutonium and radiation is very dangerous, and I think that's for those of us living around the area, that's mostly what we experienced, though there were a couple of high spikes, as I mentioned earlier, with these fires. Harvey Nichols is a very interesting guy. He was teaching at the University of Colorado, and he was studying pollen, and he had come from another university, and he started to study this, and he began to hear about some of these things that were happening at Rocky Flats, and he thought, well, I wonder if plutonium particles attach to pollen, and if that's one of the ways that people are getting the plutonium particles into their lungs or into their bodies. And, of course, it just takes a very, very tiny particle of plutonium to cause a health effect. What he found was that it wasn't necessarily pollen, but there was plutonium in dust, and in particular, he noticed that there was plutonium particles. There were plutonium particles in snow, and not only in deeper layers of snow out at the site, but in fresh layers of snow. And that seemed to indicate that there was ongoing radioactive contamination emissions into the air, and that, in fact, turned out to be true. for decades, Rocky Flats had an incinerator attached to Building 771, the plutonium processing building. And they were burning radioactive waste in this incinerator, and it was showing up in the snow that Dr. Harvey Nichols was testing.
And that's another way in which I find your book very helpful, because you chronicle the evolving efforts individuals and groups make to try to understand what exactly is going on here, very much without the assistance of either the corporations managing or the government entities managing. And in some cases, let's talk about poor Dr. Carl Johnson's experiences. Let me just do a quick little break, reintroduce. We're talking with Kristen Iverson. Her latest book is Full Body Burden, Growing Up in the Nuclear Shadow of Rocky Flats. Okay, so back to Dr. Carl Johnson and his valiant efforts.
Well, Dr. Carl Johnson, I think it's just an incredible story. He was the health director of Jefferson County in the 1970s, and he had something come across his desk that said, we would like to have you approve housing development within 3 miles of Rocky Flats. And he thought, well, maybe we should test the soil before we build houses out there. So he worked with the Department of Energy and other entities, and they did extensive testing out there, and it was proven that there was plutonium contamination in the soil. And so he denied that permit, and he said, we should not be building homes on contaminated land and next to this site that is continuing to emit toxic and radioactive contamination. Well, the County Board of Health at that time, there were a number of realtors and home builders involved in all of this. To make a long story short, I go into more detail in my book, but to make a long story short, Dr. Carl Johnson was fired from his job for opposing home development near Rocky Flats. Now, he later won a whistleblower lawsuit, but by that point, most people had kind of forgotten about him, and certainly in our neighborhood, kind of rumor was, well, he wasn't really telling the truth. He was kind of run out of the state. And that's absolutely not true. He was telling the truth. Most of his information was verified by the Department of Energy itself. This was real contamination. But there was so much business and development interest in the area that he lost his job. And I have to say, here's kind of an interesting sideline. I did a reading in Albuquerque the other night, and Carl Johnson's secretary was there, and she sat in the front row. And she came up to me afterwards with tears in her eyes, and she said, thank you so much for telling his story. Few people know of his story. And one other thing I might add with respect to Carl Johnson, many of the people in my book passed away from cancer. He himself died not long after that. But just before his death, he wrote an op-ed for the New York Times. And the title of that op-ed is Death Incorporated, about Rocky Flats. And it's an absolutely devastating op-ed, and it details the information that he found in his testing that included higher rates of lung cancer, leukemia, lymphoma, brain cancers, and higher birth defects in Arvada and the surrounding areas around Rocky Flats.
There was one case of a whistleblower who was awarded a certain amount, and then that was later overturned by the Supreme Court. Was that Dr. Johnson or was that someone else?
That was Jim Stone. Another fascinating story. I think I want to pause briefly and say that I was so fortunate as a researcher and as an investigative journalist to not only be able to do interviews with so many of the people in my book, personal interviews, many interviews, but also to rely on interviews that were done with the Cold War Museum at the Carnegie Library in Boulder. So all of these stories are preserved, and they're just incredible stories. Jim Stone was a worker who had worked at Rocky Flats right from the beginning. He was aware of many of the problems at the plant, and he was concerned over the years over a couple of things in particular. He was concerned about pondcrete, which is an odd term. Again, it's a mixture of cement and plutonium. They tried to harden and stabilize plutonium in thousands of these pondcrete blocks that stood out in the open and leaked into the environment. He was also very concerned about the incineration of waste out there, the solar ponds, and then the amount of plutonium that was stuck in the ducts and the vents and the pipes out there. Later it was proven to be more than 62 pounds of plutonium had been stuck in these pipes. So he became kind of a whistleblower. He was fired from his job at Rocky Flats, and then he became the primary initial contact for John Lipsky with the FBI and the EPA. He was very helpful as they planned the raid on Rocky Flats in 1989 with a list of environmental allegations that included incinerating waste and the pondcrete and the drums and some of these other problems. But he did, in fact, he won his whistleblower lawsuit, and then it was overturned by the Supreme Court.
You very briefly mention in that passage that actually when the Supreme Court overturned his whistleblower award, it actually had an impact on all whistleblowers afterwards. It reduced their protection or something, right?
Yeah, well, it was overturned on a very small technicality. And what they said basically was that Jim Stone was not the original source of this information about the contamination and slipshod practices at Rocky Flats, and pondcrete in particular, but that he predicted it. He wasn't necessarily the original source of information there. So it did affect whistleblowers from that point on, and it makes it very, very difficult for someone who is a whistleblower to prove their case and to prove that they are an original and solitary single source of this information. Jim Stone is one of the heroes in my book, and he was one of the people who really stood up to Rocky Flats, like Carl Johnson, like Harvey Nichols, like many of the other people in the book, and said, despite what the Department of Energy and Dow and Rockwell and these companies are telling us about what's happening at the plant, you know, we want the public to know the truth, which was also the case with the Rocky Flats grand jury.
We haven't mentioned that Rockwell Corporation took over the management of the plant in 1974. I found it really interesting the role that various nuns played in all this. Tell us about the nuns, the Sisters of Loretta and their cohort.
The Sisters of Loretta were just incredible. They were one of the first protesters out at Rocky Flats. Those protests began with anti-war, anti-nuclear weapons protests, and then as the public began to slowly become more aware of the environmental things that were happening up there and how contaminated the local environment was, then it slowly incorporated that as well. But the nuns were out there standing at the gates very early on, and several of them got into the plant and staged a protest. They staged protests outside. They were one of the first ones to try to bring awareness to the public of what was going on out there. And they did that in a number of ways, through personal actions. They were arrested. When they were in court, they would call Rocky Flats a bomb factory or a nuclear weapons factory. They were not going to use a euphemism. When I worked out at Rocky Flats, it was called the Rocky Flats Environmental Technology Site. These nuns said, no, we're going to say what it is. They're making bombs. And many of them served jail sentences. They were very, very passionate in their mission with that. And again, it was really great. At the recent readings that I've done, several of the nuns have showed up at my readings, and I've been able to kind of follow up with them and talk to them. And they're just as passionate now as they ever were. In fact, they believe that the cover-up at Rocky Flats is in many ways continuing to the present day, that the public still does not know what is out there and what's going on.
We should mention to our listeners that the plant has supposedly been decontaminated and turned into a wildlife refuge. Talk about that a little bit.
Well, when I worked at Rocky Flats in 1995, and they were just starting to talk about cleanup, it was becoming apparent that production was not going to restart. Production at Rocky Flats ended when the W-88 Trident missile program was canceled. So they started talking about cleanup, and in 1995, the Department of Energy said that it would take a minimum of $36 billion and 70 years to clean up the site, and that they didn't know if they had the technology to do it. What that eventually turned into was that a company called Kaiser Hill was hired to come in and do the cleanup at a much lower cost. It ended up costing about $7 billion, and only a very small portion of that went for groundwater and soil cleanup on site, but it was done for $7 billion in less than 10 years. So it's a very compromised cleanup, and the standards of the cleanup are controversial, and there's very little cleanup below 6 feet at the site as it stands now, and there's a lot of contamination still there. There were lots of buildings at Rocky Flats with tunnels and piping and all sorts of things that connected the buildings and moved radioactive and toxic material between those buildings. And there were also many dump sites and waste sites for liquid waste and waste in drums and other containers on the site. And all of, a lot of that stuff is still out there. And with respect to the Rocky Flats Natural Wildlife Refuge, 1,300 acres, are permanently closed. They can never be open for human habitation. Highly, highly contaminated. The rest of the site is slated to open as a hike, for public recreation, for hiking and biking and possibly even hunting, even though there still is a great deal of contamination on the site. But the Department of Energy and the Colorado Department of Health maintains that contaminants are at levels acceptable to the government. There's no question as to whether or not the materials are out there. They are, but they're just saying that they're at levels that people shouldn't worry about it.
Which is what they've been saying since the place was built, basically.
Right. It's the same line of rhetoric that goes all the way back to 1950.
As you explain in your book, radionuclide soil action levels are what they test or what they use as their measurement. And it's recorded at 651 picocuries per gram of soil. And the Risk Assessment Corporation recommends that it should be no greater than 35 picocuries per gram of soil. So it's 35 is what they recommend, and they're saying it's safe at 651 picocuries per gram of soil.
Right, and it's an astonishing number, higher than any other site in the country, including the Nevada test site. What they finally agreed on with the RSALs is that this is the compromise. Citizens, local people were very unhappy about this compromise, but this is what we've got. The top 3 feet of soil can contain 50 picocuries per gram of soil. Then from 3 to 6 feet, it can vary from 1,000 to 7,000 picocuries per gram of soil. And then there is no limit below 6 feet. And part of the reason why I think this is quite worrisome is that, you know, as many of your listeners know, this is an area with a lot of erosion. There's a lot of wind and rain and snow. You know, as we were talking earlier, the wind is so strong. When I worked out there, it was common for people's windshields to get blown out from time to time. The other thing is that there is plutonium uptake in the grass and the trees. There's a lot of wildlife out there, and groundhogs in particular. And a study by Dr. Sean Smallwood showed that showed how much of the soil is being redistributed by is being moved around by groundhogs out at the site. 12% of the soil is constantly moving because of all the animals that are moving everything around out there. So plutonium does not stay put. I think that even with these very high RSAL numbers, the Department of Energy and Rocky Flats officials are kind of counting on the idea that plutonium stays put. It does not stay put. It's out at the site. It's in the sediment at Stanley Lake. It's moving around.
Let's talk about the year of disobedience and the summer of protests that began in April of 78. I think our listeners will be very interested in that because at the same time, in California, there were protests going on to try to prevent the building of Diablo Canyon. But meanwhile, in the Denver area of Colorado, massive protests were going on. Tell us some things that happened. It was quite colorful at times.
Oh, there are just incredible stories of the things that happened. And I might mention that there is a film that was made at that time called Dark Circle, produced by Judy Irving. And that film talks about Rocky Flats and also talks about Diablo Canyon. So there are some real similarities there with respect to the story. The protests out at Rocky Flats were fascinating. I write about the protests that were against the plant, and then every now and then there would be protests in favor of the plant. Some of the workers out there, some of the other people, local people who were in favor of nuclear weapons and did not believe that there was any environmental contamination, they would stage a counter-protest. So it's quite an interesting story. I think one of my favorite stories is a story about Patrick Malone and Daniel Ellsberg and the teepee on the tracks. There was a big protest. Bonnie Raitt was there. A number of people performed and spoke. Dr. Helen Caldicott spoke at the protest. And then when it was time for everybody to pack up and go home at the end of the day, there were a number of protesters who said, no, we want to construct a teepee on the tracks, on the railroad tracks leading into the plant, and prevent the railroad cars from moving in and out of the plant and carrying radioactive material. So what started out as maybe we'll do this for one night or two nights turned into an entire summer, and in fact, for weeks and months, they stayed out. They literally lived out on the tracks. People would bring them food and supplies, and they established themselves as the Rocky Flats Truth Force, and it's just an incredible story. And I think that that kind of citizen activism did have an effect in the long run. In fact, even someone like Mark Silberman, who was a manager out at Rocky Flats when I was working there, one of the things that he said is that when it was becoming apparent how contaminated the site was, he said, I'm worried that we may have done too good a job of convincing the public that Rocky Flats is safe, and we need people to protest and to speak up, because that's how we can send people to Washington and affect change at the plant. So although in the 70s and 80s there was a lot of controversy about these protests, I think in the long run they had a big effect.
Well, I really appreciate your honesty in the book of how you felt about the protests. You didn't think so well of them. And I think it's useful for our listeners, and especially those who want to create change and convince people, to hear from someone that wasn't being convinced. Would you share how you felt and then how you evolved to write the book that you've written?
I think the book overall really is a story of my own sense of awakening, of coming to terms with what was happening at Rocky Flats and what had happened in the past. One of my sisters, Karma, very early on when she was a teenager, she started going to Greenpeace meetings and that sort of thing. And she was more aware, some of the citizens' meetings, she was more aware of what was happening. But I myself remained unconvinced for quite a long time. And I think that anyone who, I really loved the land at Rocky Flats. I really loved growing up out there. It was an idyllic childhood in many ways. And you don't want to believe that our government would allow something like this to happen, or that these things could be true. And certainly in my neighborhood, now many of the parents of the kids that I knew, their parents worked at Rocky Flats, and the party line was that it's a good job and nothing's wrong and don't say anything, you don't talk about it. So there was a lot that I didn't know, and my own parents, you know, when we would drive past Rocky Flats on our way up to Boulder or something like that, there's, oh, my dad used to say it's nothing but hippies and housewives and students out there protesting. You know, those people should go get a job. And he was kind of half-joking and not half-joking. I think that was part of the community sentiment at that time. I think one thing that happens when you have so much secrecy and repression around a story like Rocky Flats is that it divides the community. The workers and the activists and the residents, the scientists, everyone was kind of divided one against the other. So it was very difficult to really know the truth of what was happening. And, of course, we weren't being told the truth. It took me a long time, a lot of research and understanding. It took a long time for me to get my heart and mind and around the story. And when I went to work at Rocky Flats, I knew that the day I quit that I would write a book about it. That led to more than 10 years of research. It was a huge, huge project. And so now I have a full body burden, you know, the book today. But it took me a long time to get my mind around the story and also to fully investigate the story and do as much research as I possibly could. And I had the help of a couple of research assistants to try to present a really full story. But ultimately, it is a story of my own awakening, of being able to see what really happened out there and how important the story is and how important it is that we don't forget it. Not only for the environmental problems that we will have to deal with into the future, but the cultural importance of Rocky Flats and how integral it was to the nuclear weapons system in this country.
Well, you brought up the tensions between protesters and workers and even among workers. Briefly talk about Jackie Brever's experience.
Well, Jackie Brever was a woman who worked in the plutonium production facility. She was one of the first women to work in that capacity. And she started to see things that were happening that concerned her very much. And this was later shown in a Department of Energy memo that came out after the raid. But there were nuclear criticality infractions at the rate of about 2 per month. You mentioned earlier, had there ever been a criticality at Rocky Flats? Well, there's a lot of debate about that. Some people think that there's no question that there's been at least one criticality. The Department of Energy and Rocky Flats officials, of course, say that there has never been a criticality. But Jackie Brever saw things happen that concerned her, and she started to report to her superiors. And she eventually lost her job and filed a whistleblower lawsuit. Like Jim Stone, she became one of the primary informants for the EPA and FBI investigation that led to the raid in 1989.
And some of her coworkers poked holes in her glove, and she became contaminated with plutonium and americium. A little bit like Karen Silkwood there.
Right.
We would be totally remiss if we didn't talk about Wes McKinley and the ambushed grand jury. Please tell us about that.
Well, the 1989 raid led to a 21-month grand jury investigation. Wes McKinley was the foreman of that grand jury. To make a long story short, that led to a very controversial settlement with Rockwell. The grand jurors had wanted to indict a number of officials in the Department of Energy and with Rockwell. And there were no indictments. Rockwell did have to pay a fine, $18.5 million fine, which, by the way, was roughly the same amount as their bonus for that particular year. So many of the grand jurors felt that justice had not been accomplished here, and they were very upset. And they wrote their own grand jury report, which they submitted to the judge. And that report was sealed at that time and remains sealed to the present day. In the early 1990s, Judge Feinsilver did issue a highly edited Rocky Flats grand jury report with comments from the Department of Justice. But the report and all the records and boxes of records associated with it remain sealed to the present day and are unavailable to the public and were unavailable during the cleanup of Rocky Flats. So it still is a very controversial thing. And I think the main thing that the grand jurors wanted the public to know was not only that contamination had occurred, including these problems with the incinerator, the solar pond, the thousands of drums sitting out in the open and leaking into the groundwater. Not only that all of that had occurred, but that it was ongoing, and people should know that.
Oh, there's just so much more in your book that we're not going to be able to get close to. But do you think it's possible to spend like 3 minutes on the Cook versus Rockwell case?
Yes. Maryland Cook versus Rockwell is a class action lawsuit that began in 1990 following the 1989 raid. It represents over 12,000 local residents, people living around Rocky Flats, who felt that their health or their property values had been impacted by Rocky Flats. And now with the raid and everything that happened out of that, there was irrefutable proof that plutonium had contaminated their properties. It took 20 years for that lawsuit to wind its way through the courts. My family, of course, followed very closely. We were not part of the lawsuit ourselves because my parents sold their house, even though we lived out there for years, my entire childhood. But they sold their house just outside of the deadline set by the lawsuit. So we were not technically part of the case, but we certainly followed it very closely. And on February 14th, 2006, there was an incredible judgment in favor of the 12,000 residents. And I'll never forget that day. I was on the phone with my sister Karma, and we were just in tears. We couldn't believe that finally, after so many years, someone had recognized what had been going on out at Rocky Flats and that local residents were profoundly affected by Rocky Flats. However, Rockwell filed an appeal. The decision was overturned in the 10th Circuit Court of Appeals in Denver. And then at that point, it went to the Supreme Court, and they just decided last Thursday, that they are not going to review the Rocky Flats class action lawsuit. So it's basically dead in the water at this point. More than 20 years of effort went into this lawsuit, very, very important piece of litigation. And now attorneys and residents have to decide if they want to go all the way back to the beginning and start over again. And what the Supreme Court is saying, what the court system is telling us, is that it's not enough to prove that plutonium is on your land, that you have to prove direct, immediate bodily harm. And, of course, that doesn't take into consideration the fact that plutonium, it takes 20 to 30 years, often, not always, but often, for health effects to show up. And that you have to show a distinct loss of use of property, not just property value, but use of what's called a typical use of property value. So the standard has been set very high for residents to prove any kind of immediate damage. And I find it to be a rather devastating decision. And just based on the number of emails, hundreds of emails that I've been getting since my book came out 2 weeks ago, there are many, many people who feel that not just their properties, but their health has been profoundly impacted by Rocky Flats. And these are residents, not just workers, but people who live in the area.
Well, I'm so sorry, Kristen Biverson, but we're going to have to leave it there. I so appreciate your work and your being with us today. Her last name is spelled Iverson, not O-M. Thank you, Kristen Iverson, for being with us today. Your book, Full Body Burden, Growing Up in the Nuclear Shadow of Rocky Flats, is really useful.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure to be here.
You have just heard an interview with Kristen Iverson, recorded in June 2012, when I still lived in Boulder, Colorado. The recent catastrophic fires in Superior and Louisville, Colorado, brought it to mind since Superior butts right up against the Rocky Flats site and Louisville butts right up against Superior. On the day of the fire, December 30th, 2021, winds were recorded at Rocky Flats at 115 miles per hour. But beyond that, as Kristen Iverson told us, those winds have been blowing from the west for 6 decades. Local residents protested the moral and physical dangers at Rocky Flats, as well as proposed real estate developments along its borders, which were nonetheless built in spite of the scientific findings of plutonium contamination and the strong local resistance, and which have now been utterly destroyed by the fires. It has been widely reported that abundant spring rains allowed the grasses and other plants to grow profusely, only to dry out completely in the ensuing drought, an unseasonably hot and dry fall and early winter. And in the growing, those plants absorbed plutonium known to have been blown there from the Rocky Flats Weapons Lab site during those 6 decades. The fire vaporized whatever plutonium had been taken up by that tinder-dry plant material, blowing it in unknown amounts and unknown distances to the east. I have not found any reports mentioning this aspect of the fires, much less considering the fallout from it, in the most literal sense. In response to historic and ongoing reports of health issues by people who live, on May 19, 2016, a $375 million settlement was reached over claims by more than 15,000 nearby homeowners that plutonium releases from the plant risked their health and devalued their property. This settlement ended a 26-year legal battle between residents and the two corporations that ran the Rocky Flats plant, Dow Chemical and Rockwell International, for the Department of Energy. As for the grand jury, according to a July 30, 2019 article headlined, "The Rocky Flats Grand Jury Files Have Gone Missing," by Patricia Calhoun in Westworld, and I quote, "On August 1, 1989, Colorado impaneled its first ever special grand jury, a group of nearly 24 citizens from every corner of the state who were charged with considering evidence seized 2 months earlier in an FBI raid of the Rocky Flats nuclear weapons plant. The grand jurors did their duty and, after close to 2 years of deliberation, determined that 8 individuals, including officials with the Department of Energy and employees of Rockwell International, which ran the plant for the DOE, should be charged with environmental crimes. Instead, the Department of Justice told the jurors to go home, and then in March 1992, cut a deal with Rockwell, which was fined $18.5 million, less than the bonuses it had been paid to operate the plant. The settlement also indemnified individuals and covered Rockwell's legal bills, and the work that the grand jurors had done on the case was sealed. In January, attorney Pat Mellon filed a motion in federal court on behalf of seven groups, asking that the grand jury files be made public in order to determine if the government had sufficiently cleaned up the site before over 6,000 acres of it was open to the public as the Rocky Flats Wildlife Refuge last September. But it seems there is a problem. The Department of Justice can't find the files. More than 60 boxes of documents. That's the end of the quoted article. To the best of my knowledge, the files have still not been found, or at least not acknowledged to have been found. Meanwhile, concerning the recent fires and what they bode for other areas, such as Gallatin Valley, Boulder, Colorado climate scientist David Swain was interviewed in a recent article in New York Magazine by David Wallace Wells headlined, "The Return of the Urban Firestorm. What happened in Colorado was something much scarier than a wildfire," from which I quote these excerpts. There's a lot of people calling this a Colorado forest fire. It was absolutely not a forest fire by any stretch of the imagination. It arguably started as a wildfire, mainly as brush and grass fire, with some woodland near the point of origin. But it was a wildfire that became an urban conflagration pretty quickly, just a matter of hours into the event. And that sets it apart in a lot of ways from some of the western megafires we've been talking about in recent years that burned hundreds of thousands of acres and sometimes burn hundreds or even thousands of homes, but they do so over a longer period of time, whereas this was really burning through that urban environment. Superior is not one of those towns in the woodland or in the woodland interface. It's a sprawly suburb with a lot of tract homes, shopping plazas with grotesque large parking lots. The fire burned a lot of structures in this context, which was kind of shocking. Really, all you need is wind. I don't know if you saw the video from the Costco. It looks like the apocalypse. Everybody's confused because it was windy when they came in, but it was also sunny. And then they go outside and it's pitch black except for the red glow. And there is this sea of ash and embers, literally a sea flying around. And there's other videos of just the landscaping in the parking lot. The brown grass, the trees they planted in the medians, they're all just igniting from this ember storm. And these big box stores, their structures, they're bad for a whole lot of other reasons, but you would think that the cinder block frame would be fairly fire resistant, and it probably is, but under constant assault, they call it an ember attack. If you have a 90-mile-per-hour sea of embers just constantly hitting the building, eventually it's going to find the gaps. It's going to find the air vents. It's going to find the gap between the ceiling and the roof. And it finds its way in, and those embers get a hold, and then the fires inside the building. A lot of the homes that burn in these kind of fires don't burn from the outside in. They actually burn from the inside out because embers have blown inside and started a house fire that then burns from the inside house. This fire, the first structures it hit, you'd expect to be maximally resistant. But not only did those places burn, but then the fire kept going. It hopscotches from the medium trees to the big box stores to the multi-story hotel under construction to the Tesla dealership, and then it jumped the six-lane freeway and then landed on more homes and more homes. And then at that point, it effectively became an urban conflagration. It wasn't really a wildfire at all anymore. It was burning mainly structures. You can call this fire in Colorado an urban firestorm. This was something that we didn't really have to think about for most of the 20th century in relatively wealthy nations with well-developed modern firefighting. Really, the only major 20th century urban fires in hose settings that occurred were intentional ones during World War II, the firebombings of Dresden and Japan. We just didn't really have to think about that much, especially happening accidentally. accidentally in the latter half of the 20th century. But now we're seeing it again in the early part of the 21st century, and it's due to a constellation of factors. Part of it is how that wildland-urban interface has greatly expanded, in some cases pretty recklessly. Not only has it expanded, but expanded in ways that make a lot of these structures in these neighborhoods quite vulnerable. In centuries past, whole cities would burn down due to urban fires. The Great Chicago Fire, London. There's actually a lot of cities in history. In some cases, they burn more than once. But the reemergence of this phenomenon suggests two things. One, it suggests that the risk of the physical hazard of fire is increasing, which we know it is for a range of reasons, including climate change and the historic policies of fire suppression and the lack of prescribed fire. But it's also because we've sort of lost a lot of the knowledge and behavioral lessons of how to deal with fire in urban areas. Events like this are climate-enabled and weather-driven. The climate change signal is very strong, but it's mainly in the preconditions. There's the geographic and ecological context. This fire was initially brush and grass, not a forest fire. And then there was this big urban component to it as well. But then there's the weather and climate context. The weather context is pretty obvious. The winds were insane Thursday. I was going outside to do some photographic documentation and analysis, and I was wearing ballistic glasses like you'd wear in the metal shop in case something comes loose, because there were pebbles flying through the air at 90 miles per hour. I mean, there's quite a bit of wind damage just from the winds themselves, and there's lots of trees down and windows broken. We have chunks of the neighbor's roof in our yard. The winds themselves were quite extreme. The Front Range, Boulder, Fort Collins, these cities that sit right on the foothills, they are in that downslope wind corridor. These were some of the most extreme such winds in the past decade or so, but they weren't unprecedented. But what was unprecedented were the antecedent conditions leading up to the winds. So, the winds themselves, yes. But usually they don't occur when conditions are incredibly tinder dry as they are right now. I mean, the autumn and the early winter this year did not feel like autumn or early winter. There were a lot of days in the 60s and 70s in Boulder, overnight lows above freezing. And keep in mind, Boulder's over 5,000 feet in elevation. And the summer before it was also really hot. So the lead up to this was record warmth. And I'm not talking about a couple days before. I mean like the whole half year before. A lot of cumulative extreme warmth and then also cumulative extreme dryness. This is one of the top five driest such six-month periods on record, which notably followed a really wet period last spring. And so there was a tremendously snowy wet spring, which led to a ton of grass and brush growth. And then we had record high temperatures and record dry conditions that dried everything out. And then we didn't get any of that autumn precipitation. Normally, Boulder would see at least a couple feet of snow by this point in the season. As of Thursday, we'd had about an inch cumulatively for the season. Essentially nothing. And obviously, had there been snow on the ground, this wouldn't have happened. And even if there hadn't been snow on the ground, but there had been more precipitation and lower temperatures in recent months, there might still have been a fire, given these extreme winds. But it very plausibly would have had a very different outcome. It would have behaved differently. Since Boulder is such a global hub for atmospheric science, there were probably a lot of atmospheric and earth science people who were directly affected by this fire, much more than would have been the case had this occurred almost anywhere else in the world. So there's going to be a lot of, I think, introspection. And that's the end of the quote from the article. The Return of the Urban Firestorm. What happened in Colorado was something much scarier than a wildfire. The views and opinions expressed on Forthright Radio are those of the speaker and do not necessarily represent those of this station's staff, its members, board of directors, or contributors. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production hosted and produced by Joy LeClaire. You can hear past Forthright Radio programs by going to our website, forthright.media. You can also find links to articles referenced or pertinent to the interviews there at forthright.media.